This is the Infotagem podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. In a memo to her fellow Facebook employees, a former data scientist at the company, Sophie Zhang, wrote about how Facebook ignored or was slow to act on evidence that fake accounts on its platform have been undermining elections and political affairs around the world. Other recent studies have also highlighted the proliferation of disinformation websites that link back through social media to grow their audiences. I'm Damian Collins, and for this podcast, I'll be discussing these issues with Ryan Mack, a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed, based in San Francisco, along with Emily Taylor, the CEO of Oxford Information Labs and an associate fellow of Chatham House, where she edits the Cyber Policy Journal. We'll also be hearing from our resident disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Ryan, it's really great to have you on the Infotagem podcast. And the reason we were so keen to talk to you is about this very interesting story that BuzzFeed have run based on a memo written by Sophie Zhang, who is an employee of Facebook working in their, their sort of elections integrity team identifying sources of disinformation, writing about the large scale of the problem of political disinformation on Facebook, and particularly information that is being spread by inauthentic accounts, something which by Facebook's own policies shouldn't be there on the platform. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the background to this very interesting, very compelling memo that Sophie had written and how it came to be circulated at Facebook.
For sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me, by the way. When we got our hands on this memo, I had been reporting on Facebook for the last two and a half years. And when I saw it, no exaggeration, it was one of the most stunning, if not the most stunning kind of internal documents I've seen come out of Facebook in my time reporting on the company. Back in 2018, we covered a memo called, a memo from Andrew Bosworth, who was a VP at the company, who was kind of, it was a different kind of memo, but he wrote about how kind of the ends justify the means when it comes to connecting the world. And we published that, and that caused quite a bit of stir. But this memo from Sophie Zhang was stunning. I mean, she was a data scientist at Facebook. She no longer works there. And on her last day at the company, she wrote this 6,000 word plus memo outlining how at times she was the only person paying attention to election interference in countries around the world. She highlighted specific examples, things like a country like Azerbaijan and Honduras, which she focused on. She had specific examples from India, for example, and in Spain, and really just kind of piece by piece showed how Facebook, if it doesn't allocate the resources to patrolling elections around the world, can have extremely harmful effects on civil discourse, on electoral practices, on just civil society in those countries. And we read this, I remember getting it and just reading it multiple times over and was just stunned by every line seemed to have a new thing. And I think you asked about how it was distributed in the company. So Facebook actually has what's an internal Facebook. So people that use Facebook obviously know what it looks like. It has a newsfeed, it has groups. Facebook has something called Workplace, and it's an internal Facebook that you can post to if you're an employee at the company. More than 50,000 people have access to this thing. And Facebookers often on their last day, they do what they call, or near their last day, they do something called a badge post. And you post a photo of your badge and you explain why you're leaving, and you thank people. Sophie's badge post was kind of the opposite. It was her explaining all her issues with the company that she's faced over the last, I think 2 years at the company or even less than that. And it was long, but it was very analytical. It had specific examples, and it circulated on Facebook. I believe it trended among some groups, and eventually it was taken down by the company, which then caused kind of more interest in it. It was eventually put back up, and eventually we were able to get our hands on it and analyze it and eventually publish it or parts of it.
As you said, the document itself is massively compelling. And
I mean, once again, it seems that when we discover interesting new things about Facebook, things that we ought to know about, it's a result of the work of whistleblowers or people inside the company speaking out. We're constantly reassured by them in public, be it what they say to journalists or what they say in hearings in committee rooms in parliaments around the world, that they're sort of on top of these issues. They've got systems in place to deal with inauthentic activity and misleading information that could cause harm. But then you look at something like this and you say, well, do you really? I mean, because even the people that work there see how limited what they do is. And even when people within the company are warned or tipped off about large scale groups of inauthentic groups spreading disinformation on behalf of a candidate or a president in the country, that they're not acting on it, even when they find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I want to highlight an example that Sophie wrote about in Azerbaijan. And bear in mind, Facebook, we put Facebook knew that this memo existed. They haven't denied the existence of these things happening. But for example, in Azerbaijan, she found cases where there was a type of content farm, basically. So any opposition party member or journalist who was critical of the ruling party on Facebook would just be flooded with these hundreds of thousands of comments from these accounts. And these were actually, what she found were these were people running these accounts that are sitting in some room somewhere in Azerbaijan, just trolling anything critical of the ruling party. And she outlines how she escalated this to management, how she would post to workplace about this, kind of trying to highlight her work because she realized that she was getting stonewalled when she went through the correct processes. So she was trying to be as loud as possible internally. In fact, at one point she said, it paid for me to be, can I curse on this podcast?
I'm just kidding. Yeah, go on. You won't be the first.
She said, okay. she said something to the extent of, it paid for me to be an asshole on the company's workplace because that's what caused people to notice. And it took 9 months for, I think, Facebook to pay attention to this. I think they're acting now on this case in Azerbaijan. But it just shows you the frustration that a single employee had when trying to deal with something that could disrupt kind of the social fabric of a country and discussion of basic social issues.
Absolutely. And particularly in country, many of these countries are countries where, to some extent, Facebook is almost the internet. There's a very high proportion of people that will use Facebook. And they probably don't, and often alongside that, a tradition of quite weak independent media, a lot of the media state controlled. So it's not just that this is being posted on Facebook and Facebook's being used to try and manipulate what people see and think about an issue in that country, but it's being done on what is could be one of the most important platforms for sharing information in those countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Azerbaijan or Honduras, which were two main examples. She highlighted issues in India, which is arguably Facebook's most important market. It's the fastest growing market. And in those cases, platforms like WhatsApp, which are Facebook owned, and Facebook itself are what people think of as the internet itself. Obviously, Facebook had that disastrous kind of attempt to roll out Free Basics a couple of years ago that kind of ad-free supported or ad-supported like internet experience in India that was eventually kind of banned. But these aren't just happening in small countries. She highlighted examples from Spain, for example, from India. And what was kind of striking to me, I think the most striking thing was at times she was like, I was the only one paying attention to this, and I was doing this in my free time. Like, it was because I had interest in wanting to do this. It wasn't like anyone was telling me to do this. And I was like, that's just incredible. Like, why isn't Facebook allocating its resources? This is a company that makes billions and billions of dollars every quarter and claims it's allocating resources to protecting elections around the world. But in some cases, it's kind of just hanging by a thread by someone like Sophie Zhang, who's doing this in their free time.
Yeah, I mean, to cover the lines from your article that led out of me, that Sophie and her colleagues removed 10.5 million fake reaction and fans from high-profile politicians in Brazil and in the U.S. Midterm elections in 2018, and also large-scale inauthentic activity found on the Spanish Ministry of Health's Facebook page as well, spreading disinformation about COVID. Yeah. And again, which led to the removal of 672,000 fake accounts. I mean, this is being done on a big scale.
Yeah. And I want to stress there, in those cases, I don't think there was any intent ascribed to them or in terms of motivation or even source of what was causing that. In Azerbaijan and Honduras, it was more clear cut. They could tie that to the ruling party or the current presidential party in Honduras. But in those cases that you highlighted, yeah, she found those things that were happening. It was hard to prescribe intent based on her post. But yeah, I mean, these are large scale operations in some of the biggest countries in the world.
I think as well, it gives a quite a good insight into the way in which people try and shape what you see on social media, because often I think in the committee hearings, in particular with Facebook and in Facebook's own public statements about what it does, you know, it talks a lot about removing sort of fake accounts, which are against their own platform policy. And it talks a lot about ads and about trying to create transparency around ads and make it harder for inauthentic groups to run ads. But actually, mm-hmm. the way in which it would make people try and game the Facebook news feed, they try and game what people see, is less to do with the placing of political ads, but more with the large-scale coordination of inauthentic activity, be it through fake accounts or networks controlled through Facebook groups. And these are the areas where people are using very large numbers of accounts to try and influence what people see.
Yeah, I mean, I'll pose a hypothetical for you. I mean, imagine if you're a Facebook user in Honduras and you are reading about something, let's say your friend posted on Facebook, and let's say it's critical of the ruling party. And again, this is a hypothetical. This is exactly what Sophie found, but imagine that post then being bombarded by people saying, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. This is wrong. This is completely false. And those accounts are being run, little do you know, those accounts are being run by someone connected to the ruling party. And that influences how you think, and that influences what you see, because sometimes the algorithm ranks comments and likes based on how many likes and how much engagement it has. So, I mean, you can see how that would slowly erode someone's confidence or their thought process or their opinions on any given topic. And it was interesting because when we posted our story, a Facebook VP, a VP of integrity named Guy Rosen at the company, said, basically tried to say that all she was doing was finding fake like campaigns or campaigns to buy fake likes or push fake likes. And that wasn't all she was finding, as outlined in her post. But even the idea of pushing fake likes is going to have an impact on the platform. I mean, things, posts rise and fall in your newsfeed based on how many likes it has, how much engagement it has. And let's say a fake news post gets a ton of likes because the opposite or the ruling party bot accounts happen to push that and like it multiple times over, and that trends in newsfeed. I mean, you can see how that kind of would devolve a social situation or a political situation.
Absolutely, and I wonder if when we sort of look at the role of social media in this U.S. election. Sure, there'll be a lot of analysis of that, both up to polling day and afterwards as well. Mm-hmm. If in 2016 the interest was all in companies like Cambridge Analytica, micro targeting, how that worked, and then latterly the idea of the Russians trying to get in on that as well, I wonder if this time around it'll be more looking at this sort of flood the zone concept of campaigns seeking to drown out dissenting opinion. And to use coordinated activity to boost their own messages, whether or not they're using fake accounts, we may not know. But that's the sort of activity we might become more important in this election than it was in the past.
I think that's been, it's been around for multiple elections. I think it would be tough to see that happening in the U.S. election. I think the U.S. election is Facebook's Super Bowl, especially after what happened in 2016 and the initial denial that Russian interference could have on the platform could have any had any influence on the election, and that statement getting walked back by Mark Zuckerberg later on. I think it would be hard to see, not saying it's not possible, but it, what Sophie Zhang was outlining in something like Azerbaijan or Honduras happening in the US, simply because Facebook has allocated a number of resources to the US. They know people are paying attention here. They know they're going to be judged on this. And so they're throwing a lot of resources at this. They talk about it constantly, saying that they're focused on the US election. But that just shows how much like the company can decide the integrity of an election by basically how what it dictates its resources to. So it could dictate billions of dollars to the US election and protecting the US election, but it could easily turn a blind eye towards something happening in Myanmar or Azerbaijan or name any other country around the world simply because it's focused on something else or doesn't have the appetite to do that. And I think that's what's kind of the most telling thing from Sophie's memo.
Absolutely. I think you're right. If we're looking at something happening in a smaller country which gets less media attention, then those countries are far more vulnerable to this sort of abuse. And you're right. I mean, the world is watching what goes on in America and what Facebook does during this election campaign, but that isn't the case elsewhere. And of course, you know, we saw something we looked at in our select committee reports was the people coordinating attacks against the Rohingya minority in Myanmar, mm-hmm. using mm-hmm. Facebook. And then obviously Sophie's memo shows how this sort of inauthentic activity is being used in politics or in countries around the world. So, and we can see from this that the Facebook platform is open to abuse, massive abuse, and it takes quite a bit of resource intervention from Facebook to try and fight that. And they may mm-hmm. be successful up to a point in the parts of the world where they choose to do it, but in others where they don't, and particularly in countries where having the language capabilities to do that at scale could be quite a big investment for Facebook, it's not very likely to happen. Mm-hmm.
You'd have to ask Mark Zuckerberg where he wants to. I mean, he has complete control of the company and how it allocates its resources, but it makes money hand over fist. I mean, it's doing better than ever. I mean, if you look at its stock price right now, you look at its balance sheets. They're not short of cash by any means.
No, and it would. I mean, it was just they could afford to invest more in this. And indeed, the people that the people that they do employ to do fact checking for them are often not very well paid. Often having, probably as Sophie did, you know, having to make hundreds and hundreds of decisions about things they find all the time. Without a huge amount of resource behind them. But I mean, to me, we seem to come back to a question with Facebook in particular that, mm-hmm. As you say, they're an ad business. They're one of the biggest companies in the world. They make their money by gathering data about people so that they can effectively cluster people up and create advertising audiences out of them. If they can use their technology to do that to make money, why can't they use their technology more effectively to stop bad stuff happening on the platform?
You think that's what they could do. I mean, it's just a simple, like, what is the motivation for Facebook protecting elections around the world? Like, is there a business opportunity in that? Like, what obligation does Facebook have to do that? And I'd argue that the only reason why they're doing that is because, maybe not the only reason, but one of the reasons why they're doing that is because it looks terrible. it's really a public image type thing, right? If you're not protecting elections, you look terrible. Less people use your platform, and they lose their business opportunity. But there isn't really a financial case for protecting an election directly. And I think that that lack of incentive there is what's caused the company to be so slow to this. Of course, there's been a correction of sorts following the 2016 election. You now have the company going out and saying, well, we spent billions of dollars on protecting elections around the world. They used to have this line about saying we spent more on content moderation and and security than Twitter has in profits or something like that. And just to kind of illustrate the scale, but still, I mean, clearly there are blind spots, and I guess we have to decide whether or not we want to leave it to a company that large to basically decide whether or not we have safe and protected elections. I mean, just because it's happening in 2020, and it doesn't mean it's going to happen the next time around.
No, for sure. I mean, with thinking about the election as well, I mean, it's interesting the way that the policies of companies like Facebook have almost become an election issue. I mean, Joe Biden has been quite outspoken about the need for Facebook to do more to moderate hate speech and political disinformation, and to, you know, not allow people to spread lies through political ads, where that could be that proven. On the other side, there are conservatives saying that Facebook are, you know, removing conservative voices from the platform as well. The outcome of this election could have quite a big impact on companies like Facebook. Do you think, based where you are in California, do you think people are concerned about the outcome of the election, or do you think they will just ride it out and they'll be fine whatever happens?
Do you think, I mean, are people at Facebook concerned about the election? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, or just people in the tech community in California.
I hope everyone's concerned about the outcome of the election, whether or not you live in Silicon Valley or you're in Wisconsin or Florida or Hawaii or Puerto Rico. But yeah, this election is going to have an impact no matter where you are with regards to what they're thinking within the walls of Menlo Park and Facebook. It's interesting seeing how the company has played the approach this election. Of course, I think to go back to May, the large part of the internal discontent at Facebook has come down to the moderation of Donald Trump's posts heading into the election. So if listeners remember the infamous post from Donald Trump about shooting and looting, this was following the George Floyd protests, or during the George Floyd protests, where he suggested that state violence would be used against protesters. And Twitter took down that post. It had the exact same words on Twitter. And Facebook did not act against it, despite it being what looked like a violation of their terms of service with regards to inciting violence. And that is kind of where I would put that as the spiral started for the internal discontent at Facebook. We started to get more leaks. We started to hear from more employees. We had kind of these trackers that the company took that were leaked to us, showing just kind of the morale in the company dropping. I think people are wondering, like, what happens if Trump gets another 4 years? How do we continue with moderating his language? What do we do if he stays in power? But it's been interesting watching this kind of give and take with Facebook and the president, and I guess what's going to happen in November. Sorry, I kind of rambled there, but
yeah, no. But I wanted on the other side. I mean, Joe Biden's been outspoken about Facebook and even made it a small part of his campaign. I thought in the original Senate hearing that Mark Zuckerberg did, I thought Kamala Harris asked some of the tougher questions of him. Obviously, there, you know, during the Democrat primary season, obviously Elizabeth Warren was very outspoken about social media and raising sort of antitrust concerns about the big companies like Facebook and Google. Do people feel that, well, if a Democrat administration led by Joe Biden might actually start to take a much tougher line on a whole range of issues to do with these companies? Or do you think the companies feel that they're ultimately big enough that they can deal with a new administration in whatever way they have to?
Looking at what the Biden campaign said about big tech, I mean, it's much less aggressive than what Elizabeth Warren was saying. And I honestly think they've kind of walked back from the kind of steady stream of criticism at Facebook. So if you remember, the Biden campaign was very mad about the allowance of fake information to be put into political ads. So remember, Facebook had that policy where even if you had lied in your ads, they would still allow it to run because they considered political speech to be like very important, and they didn't want to interfere with or judge what political speech was going into ads. and Biden was up in arms about that. There's also like some individuals ran deep fakes of Mark Zuckerberg just saying like awful things and putting him in ads kind of thing. But like they were very mad about that. I remember that. But in terms of recent criticism of the company and tech at large, it's not an issue that the Biden campaign has really zeroed in on, given the whole host of other issues in this country.
I mean, I think there's been interesting debate. I thought in America developing over the last few months. I've certainly noticed it around. Not so much focusing on the freedom of speech issue, which obviously creates a number of constitutional concerns over the people's protected First Amendment free speech rights, but the whole question around amplification of which is very much to do with the tools of social media that allow certain voices to be amplified more loudly than others. Mm-hmm. And do you think, could you envisage a day in America where there is a debate around whether there should be some sort of proper regulation around that set standards for what companies should do in terms of stepping in if they can see the amplification tools are being used to promote speech that can cause harm?
Yeah, this idea of reach over speech. I mean, you can say what you want on the platform, but if it's up to the company to decide whether your algorithms will boost that into kind of the bloodstream of social discourse, I guess. But it's hard to say. I mean, if our lawmakers are sophisticated enough to understand that. I mean, right now the discussion is around Section 230, this idea that platforms are not liable for what their users are post on their platforms, and that rule has kind of governed the U.S. internet for decades now, and it's being undermined by there was an executive order put out earlier this year by the Trump campaign saying that they're going to look at 230, they're going to try and change it. A couple of Republican lawmakers have now put forth proposals to change 230. So I think 230 is where the discussion will go and where the focus will go, as opposed to the idea of application, any laws around amplification, for example. But they are kind of linked as well. But I just think the political discussion right now is around 230.
Yeah. I mean, which is interesting because section 230 gives protects the companies from liability. So if you mm-hmm. get rid of that protection, then you've got to have some way of determining whether they're liable and how they're liable, or do the mm-hmm. companies just get open up to you know, lawsuits being taken out against them, this thing would just be tested in the courts. But it would seem if you remove 230, and I personally certainly wouldn't want to see something like 230 in the UK. Then you've got to replace it with something else.
And there's an argument that the companies that are better suited to dealing with their repeal of 230 are a Facebook or are a large company, because they have the resources to fight legal battles, to moderate content more strongly, to do whatever the government asks. They have billions of dollars to allocate towards these things. Whereas an individual message board or, I don't know, JimsAutoShop.com will not have those kinds of resources and may have to shut down. So if there's not a replacement to 230, you can see it getting quite ugly if it does get repealed.
Yeah. I suppose before we finish, going back to Sophie Zhang's memo, again, it demonstrates that there are, there can be failings within a big company like Facebook, just as there can be with any large organization. We often don't know about those failings unless someone externally reports it. And therefore, do we need a mechanism by which the companies can be held to account, and not just by their own appointed oversight board, but by some sort of independent body which has got the right to investigate when things go wrong and ask them questions about how they're going to address some of the issues that have been sort of detailed so thoroughly in Sophie Zhang's memo?
Hey, as a journalist, I love accountability, but whether that's done or not, I mean, so Facebook, I don't know if people know this, but is setting up what they call an independent oversight board to kind of judge content decisions. I don't know how effective that would be, how it will scale. It's supposed to launch later this year. But if you're talking about accountability here, I mean, you're looking at a company that is controlled by one individual who has majority voting power, who at will can decide who sits on the board, who serves in the company. And there is no accountability at Facebook. It is more or less a benevolent dictatorship with Mark Zuckerberg at the helm. I would love more accountability. I don't know what that would look like. I am a little wary of a government body coming in to do that, although there are multiple government bodies kind of running antitrust investigations at the company right now. What happens with those remain to be seen, but yes, I think Facebook does need to be held to more account. I just wish I had the answers on how to do that.
Well, it's been great to talk to you, Ryan, about this investigation and about Facebook and social media more widely. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to bring Emily into the discussion now. Emily, it's fantastic to have you with us on the Infotagen podcast. When we've met before and talked about disinformation, it's often been in the context of Russian disinformation or disinformation as a weaponized tool in conflicts. But I think over the last few months, and something we've talked a lot about on the Infotagen podcast, has been disinformation around COVID, how that's equally dividing communities and feeding off the confusion and lack of information there really is about the virus. And I'd be interested to know whether within your work, you've also picked up on the rise in medical disinformation and the way that's being used to exploit tensions in communities.
Thank you very much for having me on your podcast, Damien. It's great to talk to you, always great to talk to you. Yes, over the last few months, we've been looking at misinformation about COVID and how that manifests. We chose to look at the web environment, which is often overlooked. I think the a lot of the focus has been whether it's Russian disinformation or whatever campaigns there have been, looking at the impact on Facebook or Twitter or other closed social media environments. And it absolutely, that is a major source of dissemination of misinformation. However, the web is where a lot of the websites that have been consistently putting out misinformation, whether it's in connection with the US presidential elections back in 2016, but consistently through and sort of jumping on any conspiracy theory, any bandwagon ever since, and are consistently highlighted by many scholars as carrying misinformation. We wanted to see what they're doing. And also think about the ecosystem that is supporting them. You know, right at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, Twitter took some pretty decisive action and booted off Zero Hedge from its platform for promoting a conspiracy theory that that COVID is a bioweapon. And yet that story, if you did a Google search for it at the time we wrote the paper, that story was coming up at the top of the results. And I think we often, because search has now become such a sort of almost an invisible thing for us, we tend to downplay how decisive it is in determining where we end up and what we see. And as we looked at the sites themselves, we saw very sophisticated social media and search engine optimization strategies. They would tend to rank very highly in search results. And also, they are carrying adverts from the major platforms such as Google and Amazon. Over 60% of the sites we were looking at, which have been identified as pumping out misinformation for several years now, 60% or more are carrying Google ads. And so I think that there is a whole ecosystem, registries, registrars of domain names, hosting environments, proxy cloud providers, and advertisers who need to look at what they're doing to minimize misinformation and the abuse of their services in this way.
I think this is really, really important. And I think you're right to say that a lot of the content on social media, it's that is shared on social media or is posted in groups on social media, originates from outside of those places. I mean, even with really serious agents of disinformation like QAnon, it's stuff posted on other forums or on other websites and then shared back through the social network to boost the audience of it. But the origin is often started elsewhere. And I think you're right that there have been indeed some campaigns to try and hit them in the pockets, these disinformation websites, by getting Google to delist them for advertising. But as you say, there's still a lot more out there.
Yeah, there is. And in a way, although we rightly criticize the social media platforms for not doing enough or not having done enough to stem the flow of misinformation, they have done a lot more. And I think than the web environment, than Google and others, partly because they've had that glare of public scrutiny, an expectation that they should do something. When you go out into the web environment, yes, you have got the giants and particularly the advertisers, as you rightly say, if you want to really hurt or hit these sort of engines of misinformation, then hitting them in their pocket is a very effective way to do it. But there are also lots of other services out there in the web environment. It's just much more distributed. And so it's more difficult to get hold of one organization to blame or pillory or highlight as part of trying to curb this misinformation.
Absolutely, but I think for a company like Google, I mean, they have systems in place, to use the Silicon Valley expression, to downgrade certain sites and content in their search rankings, and indeed for copyright material, they're certainly for the music industry and film industry, that's something they're supposed to do. So they've got the technology to do this. It's about making sure they do it.
Very much so. And also perhaps being more imaginative about the tools that they place in users' hands. I mean, there's been a lot of progress in that area over the last 4 years in social media. You can report, you can flag things to fact checkers. Those sort of abilities aren't yet available in search. You're right, the Google and other platforms have made very reassuring noises about how they've got a handle on this, and using AI and other algorithms, they would automatically downgrade. And it's true that if you're sort of looking for news on coronavirus, if you're sort of just searching in a sort of plain vanilla environment, then you would tend to get the regular news sources, the mainstream. But if you start to become interested in conspiracy theories, the personalization of search may well have an impact in what you see. And also the search terms that you use might well throw up different types of stories that would be debunked or not even mentioned in the mainstream media. And that's where I think a lot of the danger lies. But there's the flip side as well, which is Google's role in mediating advertising, in putting advertisers together with audiences. And it seems to me personally, I think more could be done in that way, to just as, say, Twitter kicked off certain advertisers from its platform and said, we're not going to take adverts from you. Why isn't Google doing the same thing?
Yes, and it's interesting, we've seen more campaigning on this as well. So the Center for Countering Digital Hate have had some successful campaigns exposing sites that are benefiting from advertising, and then often quite quickly the advertising is pulled back so they can no longer profit from it. But it always seems to be, it takes the work of researchers and outside groups to highlight this rather than the companies doing more themselves. And I wanted to ask you, so there's quite interesting news story come out, another Facebook whistleblower, this time Sophie Zhang has written about a long memo about her experience at Facebook. And the sort of key quote that sort of jumped out for me was that she says that, I found multiple blatant attempts by foreign national governments to abuse our platform on vast scales, to mislead their own citizenry and cause international news on multiple occasions. And that she really says that this is known about, this goes on all the time, and the companies don't really do anything like they should do to act against it. And does that that from your research work? Does that chime with your experiences?
It does ring true for me. I think there are good and bad reasons why platforms would be hesitant to get involved. You know, they describe themselves as platforms deliberately. That's a deliberate choice rather than publishers. They don't want to end up being, and they say they don't want to end up being the arbiters of what is true, what is, you know, what sort of speech is allowed. And, you know, those are very powerful arguments if it's consistently applied throughout. And this is, I think, the difficulty that a lot of us have looking at it. You know, the classic example is that Facebook would remove images of breastfeeding mothers because it goes against their community policies on nudity. And yet on political disinformation, it has been slow. And the reactive stance as well, the reactive stance that social media platforms and big tech has taken to this, you say, well, when researchers highlight the issue, something happens. And it shouldn't really work like that. It shouldn't be that reactive. What we're looking for is a much more proactive stance and also a lot more transparency. When we have content moderation, I mean, there's fascinating research by people like Sarah Roberts on the plight, the working conditions of content moderators. That must be the worst job in the world, incredibly high pressure, looking at the most awful things. I understand that, you know, mental health issues like PTSD are really rife amongst those workforces, but we don't know basic things like who makes the decisions, are they free from conflicts of interest, is there a reasonable consistency in the way things are applied, and will there be appeals? I think there's good progress. What we're seeing, I think, is a move in the right direction for more transparency. But when you start to reflect on how huge that task is and the effective power that those small number of platforms have over freedom of expression worldwide, it's really pretty daunting.
Mm. I'm thinking worldwide. I mean, disinformation is a pretty international business, and we've focused quite a lot on Russia in the past. But I think there's been a bit more interest in disinformation coming from China, I think, particularly since coronavirus. And I saw rather hilariously on Twitter a picture, I think this was tweeted by the spokesperson of the Chinese government, of the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian minister, where they said they've been discussing taking, you know, important measures to combat the spread of disinformation online, which to me seems like sort of two arsonists meeting to agree new fire safety standards. I mean, this seems extraordinary. But I mean, do you think we should be taking more of an interest in China's role in disinformation, not just Russia?
I think that China is, you know, it's definitely one to watch, a very major player internationally. As you say, we tend to associate disinformation and those, you know, in hindsight, rather obvious tactics with Russia. With China, what I would really associate them with is a much more longer-term strategy, much more strategic approach. China's consistently been accused of stealing intellectual property through cyber attacks, less so disinformation, but we are seeing accusations around the pandemic coming to the fore. Where we've been looking closely at China is not just on 5G and Huawei and the geopolitics around those decisions. We've also been looking at China's role in technical standards. Again, you know, a pretty arcane area. It's not top of most people's list of things they want to do, sitting in standards bodies for years on end, arguing the toss over small details. But if you are patient, if you do have a strategy, you can have very good results through that course. And what we've seen is that we believe that China, working through a UN technical body called the International Telecommunications Union, seems to be working to standardize a set of technologies which, if they all got put together, would effectively re-architect the fundamental protocols of the internet, the so-called TCP/IP protocol, which is really what makes the internet the internet. It's very lightweight, very interoperable, very open. And by sort of embracing some of the concerns, legitimate concerns that many in liberal democracies have about the way the internet is going, you know, it's very centralized. We're seeing a rise of a very small number of companies. China is sort of like, well, we can help you with that. We're offering a decentralized internet infrastructure where everything's going to be using blockchain. It will all be encrypted. It all sounds fantastic. But when you put it all together, what you're looking at is, in fact, conversely, a much more centralized architecture, and one which would give a very fine-grained control for authoritarian governments, for example, if they really wanted to identify who's doing what online. And so we think that the areas like technical standards do present quite a strategic risk for liberal democracies, who probably felt like, you know, the internet is this global communications medium. It's very open and interoperable. It's allowed an incredible burgeoning of, you know, yes, we talk about the problems, disinformation and so on, but think about all of the amazing things that the internet has enabled in terms of communicating across borders, whatever those borders, geographical, political, finding communities of interest all around the world and sharing information. If that is in any way shut down or fragmented, then that poses, you know, a real backward step, in my opinion.
And I mean, do you think that there's a danger that if China develops a more closed web that might favour some more authoritarian regimes, that they may seek to export that version of the web to countries where they have some influence or shared interest?
I do think that that there is a danger that China's partners, trading partners, particularly through Belt and Road, a lot of those countries would be quite attracted to technologies which offer a much more centralized control, take out some of the messiness of the internet, the worries about dissent, maybe civil disruption. And if that's part of the bargain, then I think that more countries than we would hope might be attracted by that. And then there's also the other side of it, which is China has been hugely generous in building out technical infrastructure in Africa for decades now. If as part of that build out, a country gets free kit, which happens to embed these technologies, they may not even know it. And if they do, what are the alternatives to not have that infrastructure built out? And so while it's pretty clear that Western, you know, the technical community in the West would never adopt this proposed architecture willingly, and they are already, you know, making very, very powerful arguments about how this isn't needed, how it doesn't solve the problems it promises to. And so, you know, where you have an informed community who are interested and also have the ideology that supports a sort of open, interoperable, albeit messy, internet environment, they're not going to willingly adopt it. And that's where I see the risk of fragmentation occurring, is you've got the, you know, let's say US and most of Europe who'll say we're never going to adopt that. But then you have a lot of countries sitting in the middle who are like, well, this gets me an internet of kinds, so I'm going to take it. Or actually, it might give me some controls over some aspects of my population where I'm not very comfortable with them having free expression, or I would like to know where the political dissent is and how it's spreading online. So.
Absolutely. And I'll bring Charles Creelan to the conversation again. Charles, it's great to have you with us on the podcast, as always. What's caught your attention in the last few days?
Thanks, Damien. Well, I've been looking at the U.S. presidential election again, as so many of us are, but there are less than 50 days left. And the internet this week has been on fire with talk about what will happen if Trump doesn't win. And it's not only been on social media. Even major news outlets are floating the idea that if Donald Trump loses the election, that the country might face a constitutional crisis. Now, back in June, about 100 political insiders, there were former government officials, some academics, and some journalists as well, held a four-day wargaming simulation of this election as part of what's called the Transition Integrity Project. They gamed four possible scenarios for the coming election and came to the conclusion that unless Biden wins overwhelmingly, Trump will refuse to leave office and there'll be violence in the streets. Now, that's just their opinion, but they also gamed the outcome that if Trump wins, of course, but this still resulted in violence into the streets just from another direction. The Daily Beast has also reported last week that a gathering of progressive groups called Democracy Defense Nerve Center met to develop a game plan should Trump refuse to leave office. And on top of that, the Democrats are raising record funds for the transition to Inauguration Day, possibly in anticipation of a Trump legal challenge. And my question about this is this just paranoia and fake news? Is it a fictional scenario? The right-leaning magazine New Republic thinks so, and they mock Democrats for worrying too much about Trump stealing the election and not quite enough about Trump winning the election, which is a valid concern. But there are also really valid reasons to be worried about this. This week, famed rat shagger, we'll call him, Roger Stone, told Alex Jones' InfoWars audience that ballots on election night should be seized by federal marshals. He also told Jones that Trump should consider invoking the Insurrection Act. He should arrest the Clintons. He should arrest ex-Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Mark Zuckerberg, Tim Cook, and anybody else who's been involved in any illegal activity. And Trump himself hasn't helped matters much because he's already claiming the 2020 election is rigged, even before he's won or lost. There's also this specter floating that should Trump leave office, his excuse and his family's for not being investigated or prosecuted disappears, and he'll be as bound by law as perhaps every other multi-billionaire. But I also wonder if Democrats are really genuinely worried. Although they've set this record transition team fundraising goal of $7 million, citing Trump refusing to leave as well as the pandemic, but the House Democratic leadership met this week to discuss not whether Trump would refuse to leave should he lose the election, but rather would he lash out and do something dramatic, and they say shut down the government. Instead. Now, this is not to belittle government shutdowns because they're serious business, but in the United States and in the current climate, they're also fairly typical budget negotiating tactics. Either way, this 2020 election is pretty good radio. And surprise, I'll be on the ground in America's Deep South right through Election Day and right up to December to monitor the situation for us. So stick around.
Absolutely. Well, it'll be fascinating to get your insights on that from being on the ground. But it is extraordinary. And the way that through the president's tweets, he seems to be fanning the flames of a lot of this conspiracy. I saw in particular a tweet he put out to people in voted in North Carolina saying that if they voted by mail, they must turn up on polling day and make sure that their ballot's been counted. And if it hasn't, they need to vote again. Almost sowing in their minds the idea that there's going to be mass fraud of related to mail-in votes.
Absolutely, and in and of itself, that tweet is an illegal act. It's illegal by electoral law of encouraging people to commit a felony.
And I think it's interesting the response as well, because Twitter, I think, blocked the they took the tweet down, I think, but Facebook just put a note against it saying that America has a great reputation for the safety of its mail-in ballots. And there could be a bit of a focus after the election on the way in which different platforms treated this sort of content.
It's interesting. And it's not just the platforms as well, but I saw a couple of tweets this week. I haven't validated this, but it certainly looked as valid as it could be. And they came from respected journalists that in California, mail-in ballots are going out, but they're effectively folded into what looks like a Trump campaign brochure.
Interesting, yeah. I think there's been the kind of as you've talked about before on this, the sort of nudge and a wink to the QAnon followers. And I've seen Trump referring to the deep state, even referred to people maybe resisting him within his own administration as well as part of that deep state. They certainly seemed willing to court the conspiracy theorists.
I think he's courting just about anybody, one that might be able to help him and two might make the other side angry. There's an interesting side to the whole QAnon story too. When we think about it, we tend to think of folk in gimme caps with assault rifles. But there's also Pastel Q, which is a movement that's being generated out of the wellness movement and health and lifestyle movement, and seems to be appealing to yoga practitioners. So there's another side to Q that nobody's talking about. It's really curious.
Yeah, I think I might pass on Q yoga, but I don't know where that would take. Emily. Do you think one of the issues we've talked about in the past was that on the podcast was that, in fact, I think going back to one of the very first ones we did with Edward Lucas, was that actually whilst countries like Russia may have sought to fan dissent through social media in the 2016 election, today there are plenty of conspiracy theorists who are using these techniques within our nation, within the United States. And in some ways, that's where the greater danger lies. And I wondered, you know, in your research at Oxford or at Chatham House, whether that's something you've looked at as well.
Yeah, and it really came through in the recent study we did on COVID-19 misinformation, that the top performing, what Oxford Internet Institute called junk news outlets, you know, the top couple, you've got RT and Sputnik in there. But once you go beyond the household names, if you like, you're very quickly down into sort of US-based, some evangelical, but also just conspiracy theorist websites. And one of the things that just came up, you know, popped up as a almost an aside when we were looking at the sites that were backlinking to these conspiracy theorist sites. So a backlink is a way, in a way, it's sort of like an academic citation online. You say, well, I read this BBC thing, and you put a link in your site. Now that gives you a lot of credit, if you like, in search engine optimization. The more backlinks your site has, especially from academic institutions or governments, the more your credence goes up and the higher you will appear in search results. When we looked at the backlinks of junk news sites, we saw that the same names are popping up. You know, in one case, this site, the Hal Lindsey Report, has got to the hundreds or, you know, millions of backlinks to one site, providing 95% of its backlinks. And at the same time, you know, academic institutions, even Oxford, but others, unwittingly might be contributing to the online reputation of junk news sites by referring to them and backlinking to them in their research. And so it's really important for researchers to remember to put nofollow links in their papers. Otherwise, you know, your institution will be lending its online reputation perhaps to sites that you wouldn't wish to.
Absolutely. And that's so important that that people don't give you know, credibility to disinformation, you know, creators and sharers in that way, and that people try and exploit those links to not boost their own content, but have credibility within it as well. And we've talked in the past also about the way in which people spreading disinformation will look to sort of bury nuggets of disinformation in the content on other sites as well. Again, to try and give the stories credibility or to place those nuggets there so that when researchers come to see if they can validate a story, they find sort of little hints and clues that give the false impression that story might be true.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's one of those things that vanishes the closer you get to it. You know, it becomes less clear. We all feel like we know what misinformation and disinformation and fake news are, but the closer you look at it, the more difficult it is to define. You might have a very, you know, a very divisive headline put on a fairly mundane and pretty factual story. The overall impression it gives is false. And I think that this highlights the reason why it's sometimes difficult to combat this through, even through excellent artificial intelligence alone. It's the sort of judgment that a person can make and needs to make about what is the impression being given to that. You know, is this, it might be something that's very subtle, but it just feeds a particular narrative or distorts in a particular way or is divisive. And, you know, just listening to what Charles was saying about the US elections, you know, we it seems so hard to imagine that we're here in 2020 debating whether or not it's true that the US government or the US president might refuse to leave office if he loses the election. That would be unthinkable a few years ago. But we're now in a position where, for whatever reason, I think technology has played a role, but there's also something in the air that is sort of, once politics start to polarize, you have to identify yourself as being on one side or another. And that very quickly then provides a sort of crucible where you can have violence or social unrest, civil unrest, because people are like, I'm not this, I'm that. And there doesn't seem to be any middle ground for people who don't really care that much, but just want to live their lives in a peaceful way and, you know, do the best they can. But we're now having to identify one way or the other with very strong opinions.
And in such a polarized world, it makes it easier for people to exploit tensions and create more division and, you know, anger people within the silos that they exist on the internet and particularly in social media.
Absolutely.
Emily, it's been brilliant to have you with us on the podcast. And Charles, great to hear from you as well. And we certainly in future weeks will look forward to your bulletins from America. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Damien.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Ryan Mack, Emily Taylor, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. People have downloaded this podcast all over the world, from San Francisco to Sydney, Australia, and in every state of the USA, apart from Wyoming and South Dakota, and I hope they listen in soon. If you would like to support our show, consider becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfotagemPodcast. Infotagem is a not-for-profit organisation, and all the proceeds will go towards making this podcast. Thank you. Until next time.